Well, good morning. We're ready for our sixth lesson in the fear of God. We'll cover the chapter called the true character of the fear of God. So last week there was, I had forgotten, I apologize this, that the Kindle, our Kindle, not anybody else's Kindle, our Kindle edition and our PDF have a different chapter division than what the green hardcover does. So when Solideo Gloria put together their edition, they changed things around. So the first chapter, the two are the same. And last week I covered chapter 2 of the green edition, which is actually chapter 2 and part of chapter 3 in our Kindle and PDF version. And today we're covering chapter 3 of the Solideo Gloria edition, and that finishes chapter 3 of Kindle. The rest of the chapters align the same, and I had forgotten that these chapter 2 and chapter 3s were combined there, so that's where the confusion comes from, but we should be smooth sailing from here on out. So.
You said chapter 2 is long.
So I'm curious, what do you think of the book so far? So we're a few chapters into it, not quite halfway. What do you think of it? Has there been anything in particular that struck you with his style or the way he makes his points? Or does he seem to be idling too long on certain things?
I can't believe the depth. It's just amazing the depth he goes into what he thought.
Yeah. To imagine the kind of comprehensive review of knowledge, a working knowledge of the scriptures, to write a book on this topic is really, well, I guess maybe serving 12 years in prison gives you lots of time to think about these things. That's remarkable, just how much material is in here. Yeah. Okay. Is anybody having any problem with their Kindle edition? Or the PDF? Okay. Good.
My book's not loading?
Your book's not loading, yeah. They do that at times. So this first section in chapter 3 starts off with this idea of there being a lasting and godly fear, which is in marked contrast to what we've seen before in chapters 2 or 2 in the opening of 3, on how there is a legitimate fear of God that is temporary in its nature, that's not designed to endure for a long period of time. It has an end in mind and it accomplishes that purpose. And in this chapter, When he describes the true character of the fear of God, in a sense, I'm not altogether happy with the title, because the other fear that was mentioned last week is also a true fear, but it's often an unprofitable fear or only temporary in nature. It's not designed to last or endure for a long period of time. And the transition into this section is a transition into fear as a grace, fear as a godly benefit, and what does it have in store for us? What is it that we can anticipate as believers in experiencing fear in our lives? So he has a number of, I forget how many there are, maybe 10 or so, sections of describing fear, and there are a few that I want to look at with more detail than others. The Puritans were very, very good at making lots of distinctions and lots of divisions among their points, but sometimes those distinctions some are more helpful than others. So we're not going to spend time equally on every point he makes, but we're going to pull a few of them out for further review. So, the opening point he makes here comes from Hebrews 12:28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Now, the verse that comes immediately after it was one that we spent a bit more time on a few weeks ago. Anyone remember what that verse said? Anyone remember it was in reference to the character and the name of God? And why Hebrews 12:28 was an important piece of that puzzle? Does anyone remember what that verse is? For our God is a consuming fire. That's the verse that comes after this. And so when the idea is to point us back to the giving of the law at Sinai, so that we can understand that that God led His people as a fire, certainly, but that when He delivered the law, it was a terrifying event. But in Hebrews 12:28, this is not the only point being made, that God is a consuming fire, but rather, if we look at it just a little carefully here, we can see that we're the ones being addressed. So we are receiving a kingdom, and it's an unshakable kingdom. And I think even that idea of the shaking comes back to the giving of the law, where the mountain and the earth trembled and people were taken with fear. And the point the writer of Hebrews is making is that this is a gift that God is giving us. He's giving His people a kingdom. It's an unshakable kingdom. So let's have grace. Let us have grace. This is something we should be pursuing, so that we can serve God with this new unshakable kingdom acceptably with reverence and godly fear. So the point that is being made by the writer of Hebrews here is this is the grace of God is to give you His fears, to put His fear within you. So when we think about the goodness of God and we think about fear, in the modern mind, those two ideas don't go well together. They don't mix. They're oil and water. Why would you have fear and grace being united together? John Owen makes a point of describing this kingdom in chapter 12 here as saying that this kingdom is replenished with inexhaustible treasures of spiritual blessings and advantages. Now that's a pretty nice picture, isn't it? A kingdom being given to us that is replenished with inexhaustible treasures of spiritual blessings and advantages. That sounds to me like an enticing kingdom, a place where you would want to dwell. So how would we act in a kingdom such as this? Being translated to a different domain, how would we act in this kingdom? And he writes, it is assuredly their duty, their being our duty, in all things to behave themselves as become those who receive such privileges and dignity from God Himself. So there's an idea that people who have received this kingdom and who dwell in this kingdom with these replenished, inexhaustible treasures, it almost seems strange to put replenished and inexhaustible together, but these replenished and inexhaustible treasures of spiritual blessings and advantages, these people behave themselves in a manner as those who receive these certain privileges and this dignity. See, God is bestowing on us, sinners though we may be, He's bestowing on us a certain dignity. He's giving us a measure of treasure. He's giving us something that is filled with riches wherein He dwells. And the grace that enables us to live in this kingdom, to serve Him, is fear. And so if there's tension in our mind about the Christian life being filled with fear and being called to grace, the problem's in our mind. The problem's not with the scriptural truths being presented. The problem is in our inability to unite the grace of God and fear into a coherent whole, that we warmly adopt such things. But it's precisely this posture of fear which enables us to be fit to dwell in this kingdom with all of these treasures. Does that make sense? Is that a helpful way of looking at this? Okay. All right, so the next two items is that this fear is filial and not slavish in nature. And this is an important distinction that is maybe helps put fear in a different category. that in the last lesson, we looked at some of the ways that the Spirit works fear into the life of individuals is as a spirit unto bondage, right? That was the point he was making in the Romans passage we looked at. We have not received the spirit of bondage again unto fear. That God sometimes does bring people to this spirit of bondage in part so that they come to Christ. At other times it's simply as a judgment to make them afraid. So the Spirit's work is not of one type only to put people in bondage unto fear. You know, so the idea we... First of all, when God does these things, it's a good thing. And sometimes when he's putting people in fear, like when he was driving the Canaanites out, when he was putting his fear into their lives by sending these hornets, that characterization that God was the one driving them out, he wants them to be afraid, and there was nothing immoral about it. This isn't somehow akin to the kid who feels like he's been betrayed by his friends at school and he's dreaming evil things to bring upon folks. No, this is a holy and just God who is doing the right thing in making people fear. But that's not the only work that the Spirit has. The Spirit has other fears that he puts into the life of individuals. And that's a good thing. So when the Spirit of adoption comes and puts fear in our hearts, he's putting that fear in a way that is filial, that is the relationship of a son or daughter to their father, instead of slavish, being someone who is simply being driven to sheer obedience through fear of the punishment and retribution. So Bunyan, in fact, describes this work as the Spirit of grace, who is the author, the animator, and maintainer of our filial fear, or of that fear that is son-like, and that subjects the elect unto God, his word, and his ways as a father. So the transition, which doesn't take place equally among individuals, either in time or duration, is that the Spirit comes and brings fear to a person's life, which is often, but not always, the way in which they're driven to Christ. And then when they come to Christ, the same Spirit is putting fear into them as a grace that allows us to relate to God in a filial fashion, relate to him as a child to his father. It also makes us subject to his word and to his ways. We understand how he operates. We understand what he expects. And we're pleased to serve him with the respect that he is worth having or worth rendering to. So the next point is that it's also a fruit of the gospel. One of the gospel treasures that's being brought is the idea that when God converts people, he wants to put his fear in their heart. Why? Because it makes them better. It improves them. And this passage from Jeremiah communicates this idea, and I will make an everlasting covenant with them that they will not turn away from, that I will not turn away from doing them good. So here we see the posture of God, right? We see his disposition. He is not going to turn away from them in doing good. He has a calculation in mind to bring about goodness to our lives, which is under the fabric of a covenant, right? He's establishing this relationship, but what's he doing in that relationship? What does it mean for God to be favorably disposed, to be calculating goodness to us? Well, for some, it means prosperity in a material world, right? It means being free from sickness or disease or free from strife in our relationships and such. I mean, there are lots of things we could think about that would be ideal in our mind as to how God would orient himself toward us, right? But he describes this work of grace, this work of goodness, in that I will put my fear in their hearts so that they will not depart. It should be depart from me. I don't know why I left the object out there. But it's implied, right? So there's an idea here that God is working in us a fear so that we'll never depart from him. That's the end goal in mind. He wants us to serve him well. He wants us, I almost hate to say it this way, but he wants us to succeed in this relationship, right? I know, it just sounds terrible to say that.
Positively?
But that's what's happening, isn't it? That God wants to put his fear in our life so that we will not depart from him. So this is God's solemn promise to do us good. Now, the next item that Bunyan makes that describes this, and I think we should learn to describe it in the same light, is that this fear that God gives us, which puts us in a right relationship of reckoning to him, is a treasure. The grace itself is a treasure. And that's a marvelous thing to think of, to imagine asking someone today, talk about foreign words falling on a dull mind, is that, do you have the treasure of fear in your life? You know, that's an incoherent sentence. But this is what's being expressed in Isaiah 33 here. The Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. Wisdom and knowledge will be the stability of your times and the strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Wow. That really puts it in different light, doesn't it? And technically, I think it qualifies as treasure. It's highly valued, right? I mean, this is something that God values, and if he values something, then it has real, genuine value. He doesn't seem to be overly impressed with gold or silver, right? Or with U.S. dollars, right? I mean, none of these things seem to be communicated in the scriptures as something that God treasures, but yet his fear is something that treasures, and it's also scarce, right? It's a genuine treasure. I mean, if you went swimming and you found a ship buried and filled with Spanish bullion, you'd think, wow, this is it, I've made it, and I have real treasure. But this gift is only given to his people. This work of grace is only done within his own people. He doesn't give this treasure to anyone else, but he is giving it to you. So it really does qualify under a strict idea of treasure. In fact, Bunyan writes that it is one of his choice jewels. It's one of the rarities of heaven. So there's one other quote here from Bunyan that I think helps illustrate this. You know, we live in not just a materialistic, in a prosperous world materialistically. That doesn't describe it very accurately. I mean, we live in a very rich age. We have an abundance of every kind of riches. Bunyan's case was different altogether, right? I mean, he was a tinker, right? He went around from town to town repairing pots and pans and such for people. I mean, do you even know anybody that repairs pots and pans? Ask your parents if they know of anybody. I mean, this is something we've lost years and years ago. We don't think this way. We don't act this way anymore, because it's not. It would be a waste of time, right? So we live in a world of an abundance of riches. But Bunyan has this illustration, which I think is helpful, that when it comes to our relationship with God and what we have in possession to approach him, that really doesn't describe our life very well, does it? I mean, it doesn't. We are poor and needy when it comes to approaching God in our relationship with him. We need him to supply us with the things that we need in order to make us rich, right? We need him to do that. So Bunyan describes it that when poor vagrants came straggling to some lord's house, they may perhaps obtain some scraps and fragments. They may also obtain old shoes and some sorry cast-off rags. But they don't get any choice jewels. They may not touch his choicest treasures, for that is kept for the children and those who shall be his heirs. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it? That you can imagine stopping by somebody's house and asking them for some things, and you know the house is filled with good stuff, right? I mean, it's a big, large house, right? It's filled with wonderful things. You think, please, sir, may I have another bowl, right? I mean, that's the idea you get. And what do you get? You get maybe a little gruel by an angry Englishman, right? That's what you're going to get. Let's see if we can help this poor fellow. See if there's some rags or whether you have any clothes in the off bin, or a shoe. He's probably got a hole or something. I mean, it doesn't take much to imagine going to someone's house and not receiving the very best of treatment, right? We'd see the parable given of that Jesus gives of Lazarus and Dives the rich man and Dives, where he was just he wanted to just have the scraps off the man's plates, off his table, would have been more than enough to sustain him. And, you know, he's just put out. But that's not the way God treats us, is it? When fear is a treasure, God says, come to me. I'm going to be your God, and I'm going to put my treasure in you. That's how this relationship works. It's a covenant, and I'm giving it to you. See, we're not even smart enough to know which house to beg at when we need something from God, right? He's the one that apprehends us. And when he comes and visits us, he bestows upon us great treasure. In a sense, it's not even like the prodigal son, right? Who comes to his senses and then runs to God. That's not the picture of our relationship nearly as much as the son out in the field whose father has to go retrieve him. There's a sense in which God is coming to us and he's putting his treasures in us. And it's not scraps. It's not worn out clothing. He's putting his fear in our hearts. This is how God sees his gift. Now, I'm sure all of you at some point have given a gift to someone that you thought was a pretty nifty gift, right? You thought, this is something they're really going to like, and then you give it to them, and they're like, oh, you know. I'm sure you meant well, right? And the whole thing just falls flat. And everybody's disappointed, right? I mean, that's the way these things work out. You can't, it's hard to value things the right way. Well, I wonder if that's what God sees in our life at times, that he's putting his choice treasures in us, and we fail to comprehend the value of not only the grace by itself, but the value and the titles that he attributes to them. So this idea of it being a treasure is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and it's something we should strive in our learning to value. So the fifth point he makes here is that it makes men exceed. So if the Puritans wrote self-help books, this would be the closest thing you'd get to it, that if you really want to do well in life, if you really want to exceed, I don't know if they would have said succeed, but if you really want to exceed in life, what do you need? Well, you need to abound in the fear of the Lord. It comes from Job here. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? So this is God's attribution of Job. This isn't Job's friends, right? This isn't Satan. This is God saying, have you considered my servant? There's none like him on the earth. He's blameless. He's upright. He's one who fears me and he shuns evil. That's God's depiction of someone. In God's estimation, a man that fears him at the heart, fears him, is a man who is excelling, who is above all others. Doesn't say riches, doesn't say other things, but he describes Job as someone that there's none like him on the earth. Job is unique, right? He's at the top. So, all right. The next one is that it softens our heart and makes us stand in awe of both the mercies and the judgments of God. So this is an aspect of fear which actively cultivates, as Bunyan describes it, a due dread and reverence of the heavenly majesty that is fitting, should be both in and be kept in the heart of poor sinners. So this is something, this we're going to come back to this idea of cultivation later, but this cultivation of a due dread, an appropriate dread, and reverence of the heavenly majesty. And in fact, Bunyan, when he wrote this, he capitalized majesty. So we're not talking about just splendor in a generic sense, but the unique splendor that belongs to God alone, all right, that is fitting, should be both in and kept in the heart of poor sinners. So this fear, one of the central tendencies of this fear, is a appreciation of the dread and the reverence of God's majesty. To see God in his majestic essence, to understand his office, the greatness of his name. This is the fear of God in the work of an individual, which softens our heart. It makes us stand in awe of the mercies and judgments of God. It puts things in their proper perspective. So the Authorized Version reads, "Stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your heart, your own heart upon your bed and be still." And there's a beautiful picture there, isn't it? To stand in awe and sin not. So this is the idea that cultivating this dread, this sense of God's majesty, helps keep us from sinning. Right? Stand in awe and sin not. Right? Commune with your own heart. Think about these things and be still. Now, the New King James, I'm not as thrilled with the interpretation here, but be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. It doesn't communicate quite the same thing. And I couldn't, I'm not Hebraist, so I really don't know what's the best way to look at this, but it seems like the commentators are siding a bit more with the way the Authorized Version is rendering these things. And so, but just to reflect for a moment here, this idea of standing in awe and meditating or communing is to meditate and commune upon what? Now, what are you going to be thinking about? This isn't the sort of meditation that the world wants to offer, where it describes emptying yourself, right? It describes that you need to clear your mind. No, you need to displace the wrong things from your mind and to put the right things in there. Meditation is a very active grace. It's something that is not done passively, but it's done deliberately. You're filling your mind with the right thoughts. And I think that's what's being communicated here in Psalm 4, is that we deliberately put ourselves in a posture where we're thinking about the awe and the majesty of God. It keeps us from sinning. And it helps us to appreciate who he is. So, Matthew Henry writes about this passage. He says, "Here David warns them against sin and exhorts them both to frighten and to reason themselves out of it." So, remember, this meditating, this communing, this standing still and thinking, this is not passive and I need to take 3 deep breaths, I need to rest. No, it's you need to frighten yourself. Well, how? By the due consideration and apprehension of the dread of God. You need to frighten yourself. You need to stir yourself to being frightened. Well, how do you do that? Well, it's not imagining Mr. Carroll come knocking on your door late at night, right? I mean, that's not the idea. No, the idea is to reflect upon the character and the nature of God, who he is, what he requires, what he has done, to think about his word and all that's commanded. He said, in this idea of stand in awe and sin not, he said, we must not sin. We must not miss our way and so miss our aim. The goal is to get to heaven. The goal is to live a righteous life. And to that end, sometimes it's quite helpful to stand still and frighten yourself out of sin. Say, I'm not going to do this. I fear God. To be moved in opposition to carelessness and carnal security. Things seem to be going well. You think you can afford to be careless? Verse 4 in Psalm 4 is to remind us that we should stir ourselves. We should frighten ourselves otherwise. Always keep up a holy reverence of the glory and majesty of God and a holy dread of his wrath and curse and dare not to provoke him. See, one of the temptations that we face and the children of Israel face, that God would warn them about, we'll briefly look at a few of these scriptures, is that when you get to this new land and things seem to be going well, you're going to be tempted to forget about me. You're going to be tempted to think that, look what you have done yourselves in establishing this land. We have the same temptation that they did. We look at the mechanics of our prosperity and we say, you know, we do these things and you work hard and you get paid and you buy junk and, you know, we've got the mechanism in place. And that's the source of our prosperity. It's easy to confound the source of our prosperity with the mechanics in which God told us to pursue prosperity, right? I mean, he condemns laziness. But that doesn't mean hard work is what brings us prosperity. It's the mechanism. And it's easy to start cultivating a carelessness. And scripture, and a reference is this, reminds us that stirring ourselves and frightening ourselves to be free from temptation and to recultivate the majesty of God in our own mind is very important. Now, personally, I really like the easy-to-read version. Tremble with fear and stop sinning. Think about this when you go to bed and calm down. I'm not sure just exactly how parallel that is, but boy, does it simplify it, doesn't it? Stop sinning. Now you just think about this and go to bed. Calm down. I especially liked Selah at the end. All right, so David in Psalm 119, verse 161 says, "Princes persecute me without cause, but my heart stands in awe of your word." And it got me thinking, who is it that David is complaining about in this verse? Which princes? Is it his own? Leaders within Israel? Is it Philistines? Is it this group, that group? Who is it? It doesn't really say who it is that's bothering him other than these princes. But he says, even in the midst of this distress, my heart stands in awe of your word. That's an amazing thing, isn't it, to hold God's word to such high esteem, to see the proper role of its majestic place, so that the leaders of your government or the neighboring government shrink in comparison with in their threats. All right, so the fear of the Lord, I'm going to combine a few of these things. Bunyan differentiates it. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, wisdom, and instruction. And the scriptures make these points in different ways. So we see in Proverbs 1, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. In Psalm 111, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do His commandments. His praise endures forever. Now you could look at many other verses. As for instance, we have Proverbs 1. The entire chapter could be thought of as an instruction in this area. And Proverbs 15:33, Bunyan describes the value of this fear in that it makes a man wise for his soul, for life, and for another world. That this fear that God's putting within you, through his word, by giving you wisdom, instruction, and knowledge, is to prepare you for something. It's preparing you to fit your soul, to get it fit for heaven, to be thinking the right thoughts. And what's beautiful about these things is not only does it serve in the life to come, and it serves us now, but this is part of the package of grace that God gives each of His children when He converts them. He gives us this fear. And this fear is to set us on the right pathway. It's to give us a proper orientation as we walk through life. It's to motivate us and to lift our heads. That's the purpose of this biblical wisdom, of this instruction of reading Proverbs, isn't to help you manage your finances well. I mean, that's not the end result, right? I mean, there are some very helpful things about managing your money that you shouldn't pledge for surety. You shouldn't put your trust in silver or in riches, right? I mean, there are lots of things. There are lots of good practical advice about for young men to avoid and to flee from the immoral woman, right? There's things that describe the value of a tranquil domestic life. Sometimes it's depicted in its contrast, right? It's better to dwell in the corner of a rooftop than in a house with a contentious woman. There's a bunch of advice in Proverbs that we look at, and it does have practical value for orienting our life here, but it teaches us wisdom to make our lives here oriented in such a way that the transition to heaven is natural in our thinking. We're thinking along heavenly patterns to be brought back down to us here. Alright, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil, to hate sin, and to hate vanity. You know, it's easy in the Christian life to be enticed by sin. That's a given, right? I mean, that's the purpose. The very fabric of a temptation is to entice you some way, right? I mean, that's the idea behind it. Fear helps us to distance ourselves from the carnality in our life, which is inclined to succumb to these temptations. So fear teaches us how to distance ourselves from temptation. So sin and vanity are the sweet morsels of the fool. Right? This is to contrast the fool and the wise man. The fear of the Lord leads us to wisdom, but those who don't have it are like fools. They're sin and vanity. They're sweet morsels. And what the carnal appetite of the flesh runs after. This is the end of people who are unregenerate, is to, in the end, they've got nothing left but to satisfy their own desires, and to flee from these things is just not something that's in their mind. So this verse in Proverbs here, in mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity, and by the fear of the Lord one departs from evil. Well, in a mechanical sense, how does that work? Well, we'll look at the outflowing of grace in the second section of this class, but one of the things it does is it keeps you focused on the majesty of God. It keeps you focused on what is it that God has done in a fearful way to secure the forgiveness of my sins. Well, how about he sent his own son and then killed him as a sacrifice for your sins? Now that's majestic. To imagine God in heaven, and where the angels are not even allowed to look on his face because of the terrible majesty. And he sends his son to save us. This is a good motivation when we think of these things, to flee from sin. But the idea of simply departing from evil leaves us a little short-handed, I think. Within broader themes of Scripture, there is an idea that we should be actively cultivating a hatred for sin. So it's not enough to just simply run or to keep from dabbling in sin. The fearful grace is given to us, teach us to hate sin. So I don't want you to leave with the idea of thinking that the fear of God merely helps us in avoiding sin. If in the end all you've done is avoid sin, well, you've taken one step, but you've not walked very long upon what is a long path. You need to travel the entire length of that journey. And it begins with learning to hate sin. Now, we live in a world where hatred of any kind is frowned upon, it's looked upon, it's made fun of, you know. Only haters hate, you know. What a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, but it's there. People think hatred is bad. Hatred is good, provided you hate the right things. Now, if you hate your brother, well, that's the wrong thing, right? That's a sin. But there is no vice in hating sin. And it's a grace that we should actively cultivate. So let me give you just a few examples. It's not enough that you tell the truth. You need to hate lying. So you need to actively cultivate a hatred of lying and a love for the truth. You can't merely try to participate in truth-telling, or I try to tell the truth. That's not the goal in life, is to learn to try to tell the truth. The goal in life is to walk along God's paths, oriented by the wisdom, instruction, and knowledge that He has cultivated within you through His Word, so that you hate lying and you love the truth. So you should love hard work, and you should hate idleness. Now that doesn't mean, since tomorrow is a federal holiday, that if you take the day off, you're sinning. That's not what it means. But if you're a slothful person, you need to hate sloth, and you need to love the virtue of hard work. How about loving our spouses and avoiding pornography? No. that doesn't capture it. The fear of God will make you love your spouse and hate pornography. It's not enough to run from it like a frightened schoolgirl and think that you've accomplished something. Right? And unfortunately, the inside of us loves sin enough that we really don't want to have to hate it. Right? We don't want to have to hate our good friends. But that's what the fear of God cultivates within us, is a knowledge of learning to hate that which is an abomination. How about we love contentment and we hate discontentedness? Yeah? You see, to actively cultivate these virtues requires wisdom, knowledge, instruction, so that we might learn to hate evil, to hate sin, to hate vanity. We're going to run out of time here, so we're going to hurry through some of this. This fear is a fountain of life. Proverbs 14. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life to turn one away from the snares of death. Proverbs 19. The fear of the Lord leads to life, and he who has it will abide in satisfaction. He will not be visited with evil. That covers the first half of the Solideo Gloria chapter 3, and we'll save the next one for next week. I was overly ambitious and what we would get done. So, actually, we're not meeting next week. We have the ladies' prayer meeting, and the men will be meeting. It'll be the first week in September. This is a good time for an announcement that we'll have an irregular schedule in the month of September. I'm going to be gone the third Sunday in September, and we may have a short recap of another class lasting a week or two. So. For the time being, just make sure you've read the first three chapters of whatever edition you have, and you should be in good shape, and we'll finish up the true character of the fear of God next week. So we still have a few moments for questions and comments. What do you guys think? Am I going too fast, too slow? We covered a lot of material last week, but are we just about right? Is this the right pace? Okay. Vicki.
You mentioned about to love righteousness and to hate sin requires wisdom, knowledge, and instruction. Does Bunyan go into that?
He has quite a few what they call practical uses and examinations, and I don't remember offhand if he goes into more detail there. He does describe a little bit more in the second half of this lesson about where this fear flows from, its outworking, in particular with its instruction in the Word and with faith. So it's touched on there, but I don't remember where else in the book he may spend a little bit of time on it. Personally, I find this whole love which is good and hate which is evil to be an enormously difficult task. Now, I have far too much friendliness with evil to think it's an easy task. It's easy to summarize, but wow, is it hard to do. So, yeah. Anything else? All right, let's pray.